Yeah, then let's get started. Let me begin by a brief review of some of yesterday's highlights. I was showing you the KLT formula to evaluate sphere integrals as they arise in low string amplitudes. I was using this notation W to denote the closed string friend of the disk integral Z, where the two orderings refer to two Park Taylor factors, one in the Z's, one in the Z bars, so related by complex conjugation. And you will get some reading homework to check that these guys factorize into disk integrals, or to go through the four-point check explicitly. And they factorize up to some alpha prime dependent kernel, which is full of complex phases, and which eventually conspire to trigonometric functions, to sines of pi times the Mandelstams. This is quite similar to the monotomy relations satisfied by these disk integrals. But yeah, the combinatorics of this formula is nothing that new. I mean, it's just the same combinatorics that you already saw in the field theory KLT. I mean, there was this field theory kernel S0 that we have seen quite a lot already in the first week. And this KLT formula is just an alpha prime upgrade, if you wish. Now, in the conventional superstring, you just take the bilinear in these disk integrals and you use the same alpha prime on both of the sides. But as you learned from Piotr, there's a second quantization scheme for strings that, apart from the conventional superstring, you can look at a twisted or chiral version where you flip the notion of creation and annihilation operators on one of the sides. So this has dramatic consequences like truncating the spectrum to a finite number of states. And of course, the amplitudes should know about that. And it's a bit delicate to get well-defined integrals in these amplitudes if you go through this twist carefully. And a pragmatic version of dealing with these potential divergences is to just define what the twisted string version of that sphere integral is. That definition is use the same KLT formula as in the untwisted case, and all you do is flip the sign of alpha prime on one of the two sides. So the net effect of reversing the role of creation annihilation operators is to change the sign in the anti-holomorphic part of the two-point function of the free boson, and the final fingerprint of that, it's quite sensible to take this as the definition, flip alpha prime on one of the sides of the KLT formula. And quite dramatically, the right-hand side of this chiral KLT becomes independent on alpha prime. I mean, this is far away from obvious. There's a lot of delicate math behind that, where you should ask Sebastian. He's definitely the world expert on that. So the right-hand side becomes on the nose, the doubly partial amplitudes, without any need to send alpha prime anywhere. It simply drops out. Good, so this is the story about the twisted version. Alpha prime is absent completely. And what we're going to do today, we backpedal to the conventional strings, KLT, and look at what kind of alpha primes are left behind. More precisely, we will look at the selection rules on the multiple zeta values. We saw a four-point example yesterday where, for some reason, the sphere integral no longer had zeta 2, or no single instance of even zeta values. And we will look at the more general story, at the more general formulation of these selection rules today. I already mentioned multiple zeta values. We looked at them yesterday from two different perspectives. First of all, their most well-known definition is in terms of nested sums, a generalization of Riemann zeta to have several summation variables subject to these inequalities. But for these nested sums, it's quite mysterious what they have to do with strings. So I gave you a rewriting of these guys in terms of iterated integrals, which look a little bit more similar to the kind of integrals that the open string asks you to do in a suitable SL2 frame where all the integration happens in the unit interval. So you can encode multiple zeta values in an iterated integral where only two sorts of differential forms appear. D log z and d log 1 minus z. And each sequence of zeros and ones produces such an iterated integral. And I gave you an explicit map. If you have a favorite choice of these arguments, then I gave you an explicit map how to translate these arguments into suitable sequences of zeros and ones. Or Concevich gave us this map, to be honest. Okay, and I think at the end of the last lecture, I gave you a glimpse of relations among MZVs. And the idea was to combine the full power of the nested sums and the iterated integrals. In the iterated integral picture, it was easier to see the so-called shuffle relations, where you deform the integration domain, or just reorganize, not deform. And in the nested sum picture, they're the so-called stuffle relations, which play around with the summation prescription. And by doing both at the same time, you saw in the tutorial that this is something quite powerful, that this so-called double shuffle trick generates tons of relations among NZVs with rational coefficients. And some final word on the scope of these relations is the following conjecture. Everything we know nowadays about such Q relations points to the following general statement. It seems like all Q relations which are nowadays known among MZVs, that all of them are of this shuffle or stuffle type. And this almost connects with yesterday's lecture, but we need a minor upgrade to shuffle and stuffle, an upgrade which you haven't seen yesterday. I need to adjoin something. We need to touch divergent objects, as scary as this may sound. Already for chiral KLT, you saw that there can be a mileage to looking at a regularized value of a formally divergent integral. And here we have something similar. What about one-letter words? What about iterated integrals with just a single form, d log z or d log 1 minus z? For sure, these integrals are badly divergent, but it's quite rewarding to just pretend that they had a finite value, maybe zero. So if you take this as a candidate to put into a shuffle, you can generate way more shuffle relations than you could without it. And the observation is, if you play that game, if you accept these guys as valid shuffle participants, then all relations known up to date among MZVs over Q, all of them can be generated from shuffle and stuffle. Isn't that nice? And shuffle and stuffle have the property that they preserve the transcendental weight of the MZVs. So every relation we know nowadays over Q preserves the weight. But it's still an open question whether this goes on forever. You can shock a lot of mathematicians if you come up with a formula that relates MZVs in a weight-violating manner. But okay, since nobody has found this so far, it's the commonly believed working hypothesis that weight is a good quantum number, that weight is conserved under relations over Q. Okay, and we will talk about the regularized version of these guys in this lecture. Yeah, that's one of the first things I want to do, actually. This already brings me to the next headline of the subsection 3.3 on polylogarithms and shuffle regularization. Okay, so the idea is to generalize these iterated integrals a little bit. So the rough definition was do some integrals in the unit interval. And the opening line for polylogarithms is to be a bit more flexible about the endpoint. So we will define polylogarithms in a way that you don't commit on the spot up to which complex value you plan to integrate. And the first advantage of admitting more general endpoints is that you can give a recursive definition rather than this violent explicit definition up there. Good, so let's recursively define polylogarithms. So again, for each sequence of little a's, which describe our differential forms, we now define a function of z. So the idea is that this new argument z, which wasn't there in the zeta case, that this just describes the upper integration endpoint. And I advertise something recursive. Let's just say this big polylog with many a's is given by an integral over a smaller polylogarithm with fewer a's. So there's no a1 anymore. And instead of talking about a's, let me give a name. Whenever I want to talk about these a's, I will refer to them as labels. And the other variable z, which appears at the upper integration limit, this one will be called the argument. And I hope that I will consistently place the semicolons where they belong. Whenever you are skeptical, please check whether the last entry is separated by a semicolon. Okay, and in order to make this recursive definition fly, I need to give you a starting point. What if we have no A letter at all? If we have the empty set here, well, then it's up to us to define that thing. Let's define it to be one. Okay, so this recursively generated system of functions is known under the name multiple polylogarithms. There's a bit of doubling. Experts in the Greek language know that poly has something to do with many, and there's even more. Multiple, well, it wasn't me who invented that name. Okay, so let me enumerate a couple of nice properties or a couple of reasons why, as a string theorist, we should be interested in these polylogarithms. So first of all, the advantage of this extra generalization is that we can do much more stuff. We can even cover z's, which are not necessarily in an open string integration domain, but no one stops us from taking these c's to be complex numbers as long as we avoid the singular points. Okay, talking about the singular points, in case of the MZVs, our two-letter alphabet of differential forms only admitted singularities at the origin, in case of d log z, and at the point z equal 1. What if we are even more flexible? What if we admit some general A? For this definition of polylogs, nobody forces you to look at 0 and 1. So if you're careful about avoiding singular points, this definition can be used for generic Z's and A's, up to some issues with multivaluedness that we discuss in half an hour.
Oliver,
Yes, please.
Don't you think it would be useful for them to know what the standard polylogarithms are?
Oh yeah, this is the next thing.
The reason they are called multiple is that there are single polylogarithms, right?
Absolutely, you are taking the next bullet point ahead.
Oh, okay. It's just that those are the functions that they would see if they do loop calculations. I mean, say one loop, they will only see the die logarithm.
True, true.
So it's useful for them to see at least.
Absolutely. I fully agree. So this was meant to be the next bullet point, that you recover something you have already seen in high school. You recover the standard logarithm as the following special case if you're only looking at one label A rather than a big chain of them. And this is something of, this is exactly that one. I mean, this is something you can directly check. Yes. Just perform that integral, please. And yeah, since Freddy mentioned Feynman diagrams and the dialog, you might have heard about polylogarithms Li with some integer subscripts. So these guys are particularly ubiquitous in Feynman integrals. If you do n equal 4 super Young-Mills, then the G-loop order will give you weight 2g. Anyway, so these guys are contained in the above family. And they just appear as, whoops.
Well, even FineCube will give you Li 2g, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. So it won't be necessarily with a uniform transcendentality at a given loop order. But yeah, that's right. So these guys appear as special cases. And OK, this is a formula and now rely on memorizing it. It is a sequence of mostly zeros and a single instance of the letter 1. Do you know by heart, Freddy? Is the minus sign appropriate? OK. Homework, check whether the minus sign is correct. OK, and yeah, most importantly, here this argument k counts the number of zeros. And OK, I already used that definition implicitly. The concept of weight straightforwardly carries over. For the multiple zeta values, the weight in the integral picture was the number of integrals you do. And likewise, we still refer to the number of integrations as the weight. K, the number of labels of integrations. Yep, that works. OK, so like this, you recover some special functions that you have seen elsewhere or may want to see elsewhere. But also, let's make contact with multiple zeta values. So this is pretty similar to the Concevich formula I gave you yesterday. I could have even left this as an exercise. So it's again the following trick that for one of these arguments, you associate them with a sequence of many successive zeros. And I mean, the only challenge is to convert the convention of the zeta up there into the conventions inherent to the recursive definition. So if you're quite careful, then you'll see that there's this reversal effect. OK, so this minus sign wasn't there in yesterday's formula, and it has to do with the definition of omega 1. And let's forget about the tricky details of that formula. Let's just keep in mind that MZVs are nothing but polylogs at unit argument. That's the only takeaway message from that equation. OK, now that we're in the middle of celebrating the nice properties of polylogs, let me say that they still obey the shuffle relations. I mean, all you need for shuffle relations is an iterated integral. It doesn't really depend on what the upper endpoint is. It doesn't depend on how diverse your differential forms are. The same arguments that underpin the shuffle relations of yesterday can be repeated to check that this product of polylogs can be written as a sum of polylogs, and the sum is hidden in that shuffle symbol here. You've seen the definition yesterday, both the official one and the unofficial one. It's basically about shuffling cards. And to make everything waterproof, let me spell out the assumption that since the shuffle generates a formal sum of ordered sets, that you're of course free to pull this apart whenever you have a formal sum of ordered sets P and Q. Okay, finally, a word on the convergence properties of that polylog. So this time I'll give the info on the pessimist's viewpoint. Let me tell you in which cases they are divergent. Does any one of you spot a situation on when these polylogs are divergent? What is a cheap way of making these integrals blow up? Well, maybe we can start with a1 equals z and ak equals 0. It's just the same story as above with the multiple zeta values. Okay, so now we see that they can easily diverge if we are not careful. And the next move will be quite an adventure. Let's try to give a meaning to these divergent things, or let's assign them a regularized value. This is something which will later on pay off in talking about these closed and open string integrals. I already mentioned before that to get more power of the shuffle relations, it's useful to study divergent integrals as well. And the same goes through for the polylogs instead of the MZV type integrals. Let's define a regularized version of the divergent polylogs. And now you might be rolling your eyes. There are really a lot of them who diverge. And it smells like it takes me ages to give a good definition for all of them. But there's the following trick that everything fits into this blackboard. Let me start with two examples. At weight one, the only divergent polylogs are these two. And the divergence here stems from the story that you start with a d log t integral. And it's no problem to evaluate the primitive at the upper bound, but there's a problem with the lower bound. If you leave the lower bound at zero, as the definition tells you, you are in trouble. So in order to motivate the regularized version, let's mentally do a cutoff integral. And not surprisingly, you will get some log epsilon. Log epsilon diverges if you send epsilon to zero, what you would like to do to make contact with the definition. And now the manual move in assigning a regularized value is that you discard any appearance of log epsilon before you send epsilon to zero. Okay, if you just accept this, then what you will find evaluating the primitive at z and epsilon, you will find that this is the outcome of that ad hoc procedure. So this equation, I wouldn't say that it computes log z for you, but it rather defines the left-hand side with a bit of hand-wavy motivation. And by the same logic, it's a good choice to say that other divergent guy is minus log z. Oops. Okay, I was promising you a regularized value for all polylogs on that blackboard, and I've already used up half of it. So how can I save the day? In order to define the regularized version of the longer ones, let's just say also the regularized versions should obey shuffle. Let's impose shuffle at weight k to and larger. Let's look at this in an example. Let's look at this beast. Your first reaction should be, wow, it's divergent. But let's postulate on the journey towards a regularized value that shuffle still holds. In presence of shuffle, the following thing is an identity. Okay, and now let's look at the right-hand side. Not that bad. Here, this guy is convergent. Also, this one is convergent, and just the dialogue. And the divergence instance has just been defined. So this shuffle, by imposing shuffle, we propagate our definition at weight 2 to all higher weights. You have my word, for every divergent polylog at arbitrary weight, you can use a sufficient number of shuffles to write it as a polynomial in this one and that one, along with convergent polylogs. So this gives a well-defined regularized value for all higher weight instances. And this procedure is known under the name shuffle regularization. It's a very economic way of defining a regularized value by just specifying a minimum amount of input, and then shuffle will do all the rest for you. And if all you care about are multiple zeta values, this of course, this construction is still valid if you set z to be 1. So clearly it induces a notion of shuffle regularized MZVs. So for instance, as a consequence of our weight 1 definitions, at the level of polylogs, evaluating them at z equal 1 takes you here that any putative multiple zeta value of weight 1 is just set to 0. And that's the thing I mentioned before. This greatly enhances the power of the shuffle relations to find more identities among multiple zeta values. And just to give one more example how shuffle propagates this to all higher weights, let's just go through this dialogue identity again. So this is just using a shuffle identity. Here we have just said that this is 0, even a product of two zeros. This is the convergent incarnation of minus zeta 2. And accordingly, by using that shuffle, we have just found that the shuffle rec value of this iterated integral is minus zeta 2. Isn't that fun? It is doubly divergent from both endpoints, but with this procedure, we have assigned a finite value to it. So maybe this reflects a general moral in QFT. Just because something is divergent doesn't mean that you should set it to zero. Okay, now if you want to apply this to open string scattering, these polylogs have the advantage that you can express the Kobe-Nielsen factor in terms of them. That's something I encourage you to look at home. The Kobe-Nielsen factor is expressible in terms of these polylogs after alpha prime expanding along the following lines. So just to give and just to simplify this a bit more. I mean, integrating polynomials in log, that sounds a bit scary, but for instance, this factor here, you can just rewrite it as s to the n, and then a polylog where the label is a string of zeros. This even makes the 1 over n factorial disappear. And you can proceed along these lines to perform the open string alpha prime expansion order by order. But I guess this is nothing which makes sense to cover in the lecture. Here, let me just invite you for some follow-up reading where this has been applied. It's in that paper. And it's furthermore pointed out that you need to be pretty careful about the poles of the open string integrals. When you saw many examples that there's a kinematic pole from the Kobe-Nielsen integrals. And by Taylor expanding the integrand, you can never see them. So let me just say, extra care is needed to get the pole correct. Oh yeah, and sorry, there's a second reference. There's a second reference. Let me just be more careful. It's A1609 paper with authors Mafra Schlotterer, which should be unique from this information. Okay. So instead of delving further into open string applications of these polylogs, let me directly jump to the closed string. And for these closed string integrals over the sphere, one of the primary questions is, when we integrate a function on the sphere, is it actually a function on the sphere? Is that thing we want to integrate single-valued or not? So this will bring us to the notion of single-valued polylogarithms. And even if the name doesn't sound illuminating right now, this will also induce a notion of single-valued multiple zeta values. Okay, so in this section, I want to deal with the following problem that as a function of some complex variable modulo singular points. The polylogs we have just defined and regularized, they are multivalued. Let me give an example in a second, but beforehand, big disclaimer. The labels are assumed to be just the old values 0 and 1 in this section. Okay, so in order to get a feeling about these monodromies, let's do something similar as we did over there. We want to check out the monodromies and multivaluedness for all the polylogs, irrespective of their weight, but we can start at weight 1 and already from there learn some general features. So here on that blackboard, all the information about the divergences was buried at weight 1. And it turns out also for the monodromies, also for the multivaluedness, all the information about the trouble spots is again visible at weight 1. Okay, so here with these restrictions on the label A, there are only two things one can consider at weight 1. Either the G0 polylog, to whom we just assigned a regularized value log Z, and there's the other case, G1 of Z, also known as Li1 in the terminology over there, which is almost the same thing. Okay, as you all know very well, the logarithm has branch cuts or has multivaluedness. And let's talk about these problems in the context of the iterated integral setup. So if you want to do this T integral to obtain the log or its regularized value, the idea is that you want to walk from 0 to the argument z. So the journey you are planning for is essentially this one, from the origin to z. Okay, there's the point 1 somewhere, but this doesn't play a role. And now the issue with the multivaluedness is it enough to specify the endpoints, or do I need to give you more information about the path? Well, the sad truth is, yes, I do need to give you an extra information. Namely, I need to distinguish the direct path here from making a detour. Y dotted, let's make it a solid line. Okay, so here I'm just inserting a little detour into the path. If we take this yellow detour along, we are still walking from 0 to z, but we are catching a monodromy. Which is trivial to compute. This is just 2 pi I. Let's call this circle around the origin C0. And this 2 pi I monodromy, it doesn't depend on the radius. Yeah, it's just this toy example in complex analysis. So this contour integral here, this is keeping track of the multivaluedness. And of course, you can do multiple rounds around the origin and get a multiple of 2 pi I. So this is just reminding you of the old problem with the logarithm's multivaluedness. And a similar cartoon can be drawn for the G1 of Z. So here, the monodromy trouble stems from a different point. So there, okay, the original plan is again to walk from the origin to some point z, to the argument. But you might again be tempted to take a detour. And this time, the danger stems from the singular point t equal 1. So this time, the multivaluedness stems from the possibility to make that detour. So let's call this circle C1. And the monodromy is almost identical to the previous case. Okay, I hope not too many people of you fell asleep now that I'm telling you old stuff that you knew for ages again. But this is meant to set the stage for the properties at higher weight. The monodromies are, at the end, a property of the differential forms. They are a property of the dt over t, and they are a property of the dt over t minus 1. And if we generalize to higher weight, all we do is taking multiple copies of these d log t forms. So there should be a way to transfer this knowledge here to higher weight. So let me spell out how this goes. So more generally, if you look at a polylog whose labels are in the restricted set 0 and 1, then you have monodromies generically around both of the singular points. Maybe this is something I should have pointed out above there. In case of the G0, it's harmless to do a detour around 1. In the above case, I only drew the dangerous circle. The other one doesn't induce any monodromy because dt over t is non-singular at t equal 1. And likewise there. Here you're welcome to go as many times around the origin as you wish without catching monodromies. But if you have a chain where both 0 and 1 occurs, you have monodromy around both singular points, both 0 and 1. So in a generic situation, both of these need to be taken care of. So in other words, you should check what happens if you deform your integration path by these circles around the singular points. So you need to check out these two monodromies and what you schematically get. You always get some powers in 2 pi I, at least one power, simply because the monodromies boil down to checking out the properties of the d log z forms, which immediately lands you on 2 pi I. And now, when you have multiple integrations, there's a bit of combinatorics. How many of your d log z forms are affected? How many of them transform into 2 pi I? But there's nothing intrinsically new. Okay, now suppose you have locked in the weight k here. And suppose we look at the term in the monodromy with m powers of 2 pi I. What can we say about the rest? Okay, in order to see this, the above examples are insufficient, but I hope you trust me if I say that along with these 2 pi I's, you still get polylogs of lower weight. Okay, and now the most important word in this equation is this one. If your starting point has weight k, and if you look at the monodromies, there's at least one power of 2 pi I, and then the leftover polylog has lower weight, k minus m. This is really smaller than k, strictly smaller. And this is a property that mathematicians call unipotent monodromies. Okay, just to give you a fancy word to show off at the next party. and what it means for us. It's wonderful news. We can proceed recursively in order to heal these monodromies. Oops. Because this has lower weight, it is possible to recursively heal those monodromies. And the strategy is that you should add some objects with the opposite monodromies. So here it's important that you work with a complex conjugate variable. Luckily, you already know all of this, since I'm sure all of you have looked at the single-valued version at weight 1. I think you all know that the branch cuts of the log are immediately killed if you look at log of modulus z. This is a much better behaved function than log of z without the modulus. So this one is a single-valued function. On the complex plane modulo the singular point. So let's just connect the stuff you already know with a general formalism on the blackboard. So when we do logarithm of modulus z square, this is log of z plus log of z bar. Log of z is known as g0. And well, we just repeat the same thing with z bar. Oops. Okay. This is our first example of a single-valued polylogarithm. And I'm too lazy to spell out single-valued all the time. Whenever you see an SV, that's single-valued. For instance, for this single-valued package, let's just introduce the notation GZV. This subscript is a promise to your reader that you have already taken care of all these monodromies. Okay, I promised you something recursive, and I've just given you the start of the recursion. The start of the recursive procedure to construct single-valued polylogarithms is that good old friend log of modulus z square. And for the higher weight cases, the hard work was done by Francis Brown in 2004. Brown did back then, he constructed a unique single value completion for all the polylogarithms here of that form with labels in 0 and 1. So Francis Brown found a way to define a GSV for any sequence of zeros and ones. And the idea is to stick as close as possible to the holomorphic side. So the zeroth approximation to this single-valued polylog is just start with a holomorphic instance, something which you would like to study, but where you have a monodromy problem, and then add products. Products of lower weight g's at z and z bar, and sometimes even mzv's. And okay, the only boundary conditions are that the anti-holomorphic stuff, the g at z bar, has at least weight 1. And what you need to add, this is a matter of canceling the unipotent monodromy. So here, for instance, the first approximation would be that function, then you see, oh, damn it, we have a monotomy problem around the origin. And then you add some function of z bar to heal that. And here, Francis Brown found a recursive procedure to just determine what is the stuff to heal, the monotomies of that one. Okay, and the weight of these correction terms is conserved. If you take everything together, it still has weight k. And since there's at least one unit of weight sitting in the z bar guy, then the rest has lower weight, the holomorphic polylogs. Okay, I guess this is calling for an example, actually two examples. So weight one you have already seen, and there's nothing new if we trade the 0 for 1. But now let's do weight 2. What is the single-valued completion of this one? Essentially the Li2. So here, the first move is to add a product, weight 1 and z, weight 1 and z bar. But this product might itself give you a further tail of monodromies. So usually this product can be thought of as taking you from weight k all the way down to weight 0. So it's about all distributions of the weight between the z and z bar variable. Oops. So this is just one thing that comes out of Francis Brown's construction. And to give you one more, weight 3. Again, starting point is the meromorphic version. Then the tail of corrections starts like this and goes on like that. By the way, I hope that here you see the necessity to do shuffle regularization. We started with something innocently convergent, but somehow the single-valued completion of Francis, it drove you to a divergent instance of a polylog. So just a little side remark, it's better to have the shuffle regularization in the toolbox when you go for this journey. So let me stress it once more. Everything in that purple box here is the z bar dependent tail determined by this unipotent monodromy. Okay, and these two examples will be quite valuable to get some intuition about the multiple zeta values to be derived from this. So I've told you before that multiple zeta values are polylogs at z equal 1. So why not study the z equal 1 version, not just of the old school polylogs, but also of the single valued ones? Let's compare. What do we get when we set z equal 1, either before or after this single-valued completion? So for instance, we've seen it in various flavors already. This polylog here, whoops, at z equal 1, lands you on minus zeta 2. So what would be the analogous evaluation of the single-valued version? Well, by the shuffle regularization trick, to get from here to there, you catch a minus sign. So there is a relative minus sign between the zeta 2 from the holomorphic and the zeta 2 from the anti-holomorphic part. You get 0. And let's repeat that exercise for the wave 3 example over here. So just to be fully clear, we just identified a minus zeta 2 here. We just identified a plus zeta 2 here. And of course, this one goes to 0 with shuffle regularization. And here we have a similar story at wave 3. Some 0. And now we have two sources of zeta 3. That one is minus zeta 3. And here, okay, it's a bit of shuffle regularization. You haven't seen that particular example, but let me quote the result. By shuffle regularization, this one becomes minus zeta 3. The same one as we had in the first term. Okay, to return to this comparison here. It seems to be quite crucial whether the weight is even or odd. This distinction between even and odd weights, it seems to control the relative sign of what the holomorphic and what the anti-holomorphic part gives you. So this time it's minus 2 zeta 3. It's constructive interference rather than destructive interference. So this is one of the rare occasions where it's crucial to keep track of all the nifty details of the minus signs. Okay, so this is the motivation to introduce the notion of single-valued multiple zeta values. You can think of this as the following diagram of moves and manual operations. Let's start from a multiple zeta value and remember its origin from a polylogarithm, from one of the formula on the earlier blackboards. You can get this from an explicitly known polylog if you evaluate it at z equal 1. And even though you're just interested in the evaluation of that guy, you can still contemplate how it depends on the dummy variable z. In particular, the dependence on z allows you to assign a single-valued friend to it. There's a unique way of killing the monotomies of this as a function of z. By Francis Brown's result. So let's look at the corresponding g single-valued with the same entries. Okay, and now this will serve as our definition of single-valued multiple zeta values. Let me take this as defining what we mean by zeta single-valued. Yeah, it's a funny detour that we are going. in the first place, all we want to do is multiple zeta values. But it's completely obscure how you could directly walk from here to there. This shortcut, well, it doesn't really work. It's obscure because there's no z variable which could cause monodromies. So the fact that there is secretly a z variable, that this gives us this extra structure needed to find a single-valued counterpart. And OK, let's apply this general logic to our example over there. So here we have seen how the pre-single-valued and post-single-valued polylogs evaluate at unity. From here, we have inferred the first two examples. This one evaluates to the single-valued version of zeta 2. So this 0 is the single-valued zeta 2. And likewise, from the second example, this one computes minus the single-valued of zeta 3. Since we didn't get 0 here, but minus 2 times zeta 3, the conclusion is that you get this funny factor of 2. Okay, and I hope you agree with me that it's no problem to do this again and again for higher and higher weights. So let me give you some more general formula. For instance, if you take a generic even single zeta value, then single value will kill it. And in contrast, if you take a generic odd single zeta value, then single value will double it. So it's the same story which you have already seen in action. The big question is, how many minus signs do you have when comparing this one to that one? It's really the same mechanism all over again. And maybe I should give you also a higher depth example. I told you yesterday that the first higher depth zeta value, which you can't eliminate by virtue of shuffle and stuffle, is this one at weight 8. Or maybe any other higher depth zeta value at weight 8, if you don't like this choice of arguments. And if you single value that one, then it becomes the product of zeta 3, zeta 5. Before single valued, it's irreducible. But after single valued, it becomes reducible to this product. So to already give a little spoiler, that's the reason why the closed string doesn't have zeta 3, 5. But there is a higher depth zeta value in the closed string, the first one at weight 11. And the origin of that is the following. If you take this triple zeta, I mean at weight 11, you necessarily have something of depth 3 in your basis, depth 3 or even larger. And here, the single-valued image goes like this. OK, so all of this is a consequence of running Brown's procedure. I couldn't hold back the surprise. I think I already spoiled it. So as you can imagine, the next part will be to talk about closed string amplitudes. As single-valued open string amplitudes. We had this long discussion of all the math formalism. Now it's time to go to harvest mode and see how all of these definitions help us to make concise statements on how open and closed strings are related. Okay, so let me start with a careful definition of what we mean by a single-valued projection. Okay, the first part is pretty obvious. Since each zeta value has just been assigned a single-valued friend, and let's just define, whenever I have a bunch of zeta values and I write a big SV on the left-hand side, it just instructs you to replace all of them like this. And I will later on hit quite involved expressions with SV. So let's just define, whenever you see an SV, it is meant to be linear with respect to Sij. Suppose I hit a polynomial in Sij with zeta decorations with SV, then you just shift the SV past the Sij. And the same if there's a polarization vector like those in the amplitudes. Okay, and the other thing is single value is multiplicative. Well, actually, it's a bit misplaced to put that information here. I should have rather said it before that by this construction of Francis, there is a multiplicative property to the single-valued zetas. The single-valued version of a product is the product of the single-valued versions. It's probably easier to look at that equation rather than listening to this tongue-twisting sentence I just said. Huh. Okay, so this is how you should understand the SV that will appear now on a couple of formula. Okay, warm-up example. Let's go for 4 points. Let's see whether SV has any illuminating effect on 4-point open string data. Let's just play this experiment and hit one of our disk integrals with SV. And by all these definitions and disclaimers I've just made, the only thing that you will single value is the part which depends on zeta values. I can pull SV past this one. Maybe I should have said linear with respect to rational functions of Sij, but I think you get the moral. Okay, so here I'm quoting the result for this 4-point disk integral. And by the multiplicative property, when we are about to apply SV to an exponential, I can directly pull it in. I can directly act here. And among other things, this action here will kill the even values of n. So you arrive at an exponential where only the odd zeta values contribute. And since we are pulling in the SV, you get a factor of 2. It's that guy. Okay, and that minus sign, well, it will then be a minus 1 for all terms. And amusingly, the third Mandelstam invariant in here will always be expressible as plus S13 to the power 2k minus 1. Okay, so when the dust settles and when you compare it with the analogous expression for the sphere integral W, you will discover that this is nothing but the alpha prime expansion of that integral here, one of the Park-Taylor sphere integrals. Isn't that nice? It seems like the single-valued projection takes us from the Zs to the Ws. Or let me make the same statement again at the level of amplitudes. If you plug this into the formula for the closed string amplitude, so the closed string four-point amplitude can be written as some A Young-Mills and a sphere integral sandwiched in between. So here I'm choosing the BCJ basis in an asymmetric manner for convenience. Convenience being I want to reuse that result over there. So we have just identified that this is nothing but SV of the analogous disk integral. And by thinking a little bit bigger, since we can put all the polarizations and Mandelstams in here, that big thing here is nothing but minus single value of A open. And let me spell out the final result in an even more suggestive form. What we are having here is a field theory KLT product. We have a A Young-Mills from the left movers. Now, this Mandelstam invariant, or with a minus sign, I can identify it as the field theory KLT kernel, S0. And this is multiplying an SV A open, 1, 2, 3, 4. So it's almost like GR. The only difference is instead of A Young-Mills, I put a SV open on the right-hand side. So this is on the nose, the field theory way of performing the KLT product. And yeah, let me stress, this is going far beyond the scope of string theory KLT. I mean, in string theory KLT, you would see the S alpha, some trigonometry, and all orders in alpha prime in that sign. So there are zeta 2s all over the place. They have no clue from the opening line of KLT that all the even zetas would cancel in the end. So this is a rewriting that goes far beyond KLT. I shouldn't badmouth the monumental work of KLT, but if there's one thing to criticize, then it's camouflages the dropout of the even zeta values. And this dropout is completely manifest in that expression. Okay, having told the four-point story, let us generalize. Oops. Okay, here at 4 points, the entire calculation was happening in front of your eyes. In the tutorial, you derived this exponential of zeta values as the exact alpha prime expansion. And I wish I could offer you the same at higher points. Well, I can't within the time frame of the lecture, but the literature can. So let me later on give you some references. When it comes to endpoint integrals, all the data we have, all the expansions known for open string and closed string integrals, all of that data points to the following general statement. And since it's data-driven, it's a conjecture. Suppose you're looking at one of the usual sphere integrals in Park-Taylor form. Then the conjecture is this one you get by pretending it's a disk. Pretending it's a disk integral and hitting everything with single valued at the end of the day after you have performed the alpha prime expansion. So the amusing net effect of this single valued seems to be, so if the conjecture is true, then the net effect of single value is the following. So in here, the independent information is about an integrand, a Park-Taylor, and an integration cycle. So before doing SV, there's an integration cycle. But after SV, we are looking at a sphere integral, where the independent information was a holomorphic cycle and an anti-holomorphic cycle. So it seems like what SV is doing, it trades the information about the domain for some information on an integrand on, say, the anti-holomorphic Park-Taylor. It's somehow pairing up co-cycles with cycles, or more precisely, twisted co-cycles, cycles. Yeah, this was pretty surprising to us, and it still remains to find a solid proof for that. But even in absence of the proof, let me give at least some evidence why this is not any kind of obvious nonsense. Some arguments why this is reasonable to be true. Let me start with the weakest piece of evidence. It's of course consistent with the alpha prime to zero limit. You get the doubly partial amplitudes in both cases. But this is maybe a bit too simple because SV is trivial at the alpha prime to zero limit. I mean, the alpha prime to zero limit is such that you throw away all the multiple zeta values. And SV, maybe I didn't define it explicitly, SV of 1 is still 1. Okay, so this is just the zeroth order sanity check, but a slightly less trivial sanity check is what were the relations in fiddling around with cycles versus fiddling around with Park-Taylors. So if you want to trade a generic cycle for a combination of basis cycles, you run monodromy relations. So it's a non-trivial check whether this claim here is consistent with monodromy relations. What started out as monodromy relations here should better map into the BCJ relations there, which are known to hold for different sphere integrals. So a big yes or no question. Do monodromy relations reduce to BCJ relations under SV? And to convince you that this is the case, let's just look at all the trigonometry that you could get from the monodromy relations. I mean, there were these complex phases, and if you look at the real and imaginary part, it's sufficient to know how single-valued acts on the cosine and the sine. Okay, and the action is of course defined in the power series sense. So we need to look at what's the Taylor expansion of the cosine, and the subleading order of the cosine goes like this. This is just a funny way of writing pi square over 2. And everything else has higher orders in pi or higher orders in zeta 2. But concerning the even zetas, we saw that single value doesn't like them. So single value will kill everything except for the first term. You get this. Okay, and the analogous exercise can be played for the sine. To Avoid trouble, I've divided everything globally by a pi, since we didn't discuss what single valued of a single factor of pi is. So please don't worry about that. And power series-wise, this is nothing but Sij plus higher order corrections that start with zeta 2 and Sij cube, plus even higher orders in zeta 2. So here, single value will again truncate everything except for the first term. Okay, and what you get by hitting with SV, there's no need to send alpha prime to zero. At finite alpha prime, this single valued image of the real part gives you the KK relations. And that imaginary part after single value will give you the BCJ relations. And coming back to the original problem, this is perfectly consistent with the claim. So these are precisely the two classes of relations that the sphere integrals should obey. Oops. Okay, so this the conclusion is the claim is consistent with the relations satisfied by these integrals. It's consistent with the moves that take you down to an n minus 3 factorial times n minus 3 factorial basis in both sides. Okay, now let me come to the final word of the lecture. Let us plug that back into the endpoint function. So let's look at a simple corollary of that conjecture, how sphere and disk integrals are related. Oh, I keep on losing track. 1RLL. So the endpoint closed string integral can be written in an intriguing manner. If you believe in the above conjecture, it becomes a field theory. KLT of the following form. Enclosed as usual, we do this permutation gymnastics. We start with a Young-Mills bar. I mean, it's just the endpoint extension of a formula you've already seen at four-point level. And then there's the field theory KLT kernel, alpha, beta. And now the second field theory component. Well, you would normally expect a field theory quantity, but the second component of this KLT product is a single-valued open string amplitude that goes as follows. So just to stress it one more time, it's a field theory KLT in the sense that you take the, well, the alpha prime independent version of the KLT kernel. Please refrain from the temptation to roll back to S alpha prime. And on the other side, we have these single-valued open string amplitudes. You're welcome to do the sanity check. Is it a valid object which has the right to enter a KLT product? Well, KLT formula don't look permutation invariant, but they are so secretly if both sides obey BCJ relations.
You want to switch n and n minus 1?
I do, yes. Thank you very much. Sorry. So the big consistency condition is that the single-valued A open should better satisfy BCJ. But indeed, since we just looked at the monotomy relations, what's the fate of monotomy relations under SV? Well, they boil down to BCJ relations. This is indeed a BCJ-satisfying object. So this is a permutation invariant formula. So this is just another flavor of the consistency check we have just done at the level of the Z and W integrals. And this is not only a property of the closed superstring. I mean, this one is the formula for type 2A, type 2B amplitudes. But this kind of structure applies whenever you're playing with sphere integrals. It's one corollary of this W equals single value Z relation, but there are many further corollaries, like if you are in the heterotic on the bosonic string. By the same logic, if you believe in the above conjecture, then the amplitudes of the heterotic and the closed bosonic string are a field theory KLT of some field theory partial amplitude. KLT kernel, but the field theory version, it's a zero rather than the alpha prime, times single valued of some open string quantity, either open superstring or open bosonic string tree. And just a word of warning, this field theory might potentially depend on alpha prime in a rational manner. So in all of this, you can read in a recent paper whose archive number begins like that. And it's again fixed by uniqueness. If you supplement this boundary condition, all right. Good. So this brings me to the end of this lecture. Just to give a few concluding remarks, the time frame was tight, as you see, 5 hours to share some news on what's happened on the string amplitudes front. There are many interesting topics which I was sad to skip. On the homework sheet, there will be a few suggestions for further reading if you want to go on for some self-study on that. But of course, you're welcome to see me and ask whenever it's convenient to you. Maybe a last remark on this KLT stuff. We don't have a string theory KLT formula at loop level, but maybe one possible next direction could be to generalize the single-valued pattern rather than the KLT formula itself. Of course, KLT is nice to have, but here at tree level, one moral is that the final word, or at least my personal favorite for the final word, is just something number theoretic. That this one is in some sense an information which goes beyond KLT. Okay, then thank you very much for coming. I hope you enjoyed, and see you around.